Welcome to the Enlightened Medicine Show. This is Dr. Valerie Olmsted. And welcome, listeners. And hey, let's wake up. And if you remember, we were talking about instructions for the suit. This is part four, digestion and assimilation. Now, if we have some time at the end, depending on how fast I get through this, I may go ahead and take some questions. And, you know, Don, if Dr. Fred has 13 listeners, I hope I have one out there beside you. We'll see how it goes. All right, here we find ourselves on part four of the instruction manual for your suit, the body. Some things that were covered in parts two and three might be mentioned here again, excuse me, as they fit in with the subject matter of digestion and assimilation. I suppose you would like me to explain just what I mean by such terms. Okay, digestion is that process whereby food is broken down into smaller pieces and then dissolved by enzymes and acids. Assimilation is a process whereby the dissolved particles are absorbed or taken in and utilized. I know, Star Trek fans are probably yelling, "Resistance is futile, you will be assimilated," about now. At least I think about that when I think about assimilation. What I hope to convey during this time is how important each part of the digestion and assimilation process is, and why added nutrients are sometimes needed, as well as what part the most common pharmaceutical drugs might play. Heck, I even hope to give you some information about botanical drugs. Okay, are you ready to start digesting and assimilating all this? Sorry, I had to do that. The first part of your suit's digestion system is the brain. Yeah, that's right, fathead, it's your CPU. Remember last week I told you your brain was made of fat, so if someone called you a fathead, you should thank them? You're welcome. The very act of thinking about food is enough to start the secretion of enzymes in the digestive system. When you start preparing the food, it gets more serious about it. In other words, you start salivating, and your stomach starts rumbling. Usually the first thing you notice is a thin, watery substance in your mouth. This is mucus and the enzyme alpha amylase, also known as ptyalin, which we call saliva. This amylase starts breaking down or splitting starch. The chewing process does the gross or macro breakdown, exposing more surfaces for the amylase to work on. Saliva also lubricates the food, so it'll slide down the throat easier. Did you know that we secrete about 1.5 liters of this saliva daily? Remember I mentioned on the first part of instructions for the suit that the suit needs a minimum of 2 liters of water daily, that's for an adult, just to function. So if you're putting out 1.5 liters of saliva, that only leaves about 0.5 liter for the rest of your body. That's kind of a lot. And the rest of your body needs more than that to function. So you can see how vital it is to have enough water in the system. The whole point of this chewing thing is to break the food down into smaller particles, thereby exposing more surface area for the enzymes to work on. Excuse me. This is so important and such an easy thing for people to forget. Now, if you belong to the Gulp and Swallow Club, listen up, kids. Learn to chew your food thoroughly before you swallow it. If you don't, the particles are too big and just don't get dissolved enough as they pass through the intestines, which puts a huge burden on your system. Eventually, you may develop illnesses precisely because of this problem. Chewing involves tearing it up into small pieces, crushing and grinding it with the molars, and mixing it thoroughly with saliva to get the dissolving of starches started. When we swallow, it goes down the esophagus, well, hopefully, and into the stomach through what is called the cardiac sphincter, also known as the LES, lower esophageal sphincter. At the juncture of the esophagus and stomach, that area is surrounded by the diaphragm. That area is what is commonly affected with the heartburn and distress that's called hiatal hernia and GERD. That's gastroesophageal reflux disease. When food passes into the stomach, it's called chyme. That's C-H-Y-M-E. Its entry into the stomach causes release of gastric acid, lipase, hydrochloric acid, pepsin. Hey, did you ever wonder where the name Pepsi came from? Yep, that's it. The stomach cells not only secrete all those acids and enzymes, but also intrinsic factor, which is necessary for absorption of vitamin B12. The stomach pH is normally between 1 and 2, which is very acidic. For instance, vinegar is at about 4. Now, why do you suppose the Creator would create such an acidic environment? Let's think about that for a minute. Oh, yeah, maybe to dissolve food into tiny particles? Let me wax gross here for a minute. You know how when the food has been in the stomach for a while and you throw up, it isn't the color it was when you ate it? Actually, it's usually cream color. That's because of the action of the gastric acids and enzymes on the food. The purpose of such an acidic environment is not only to break the food into tiny particles for absorption, but also to kill off any unwanted critters that have hitched a ride on the food, like worms and other parasites, bacteria, viruses, fungi. And it helps to digest proteins in foods containing vitamin B12, so it can be absorbed in the ileum. Don't worry, I'll explain that in a minute. And to make the pH of the duodenum more acidic. And again, that's to increase absorption of B vitamins. The acidic environment helps to keep minerals in an absorbable form also. Let's stop a minute here and talk about all those H2 antagonist or receptor inhibitors that are on the market. That would be ranitidine, which is known as Zantac, famotidine, which is known as Pepcid, nizatidine, which is acid, ranitidine bismuth citrate, which is pylorid, and cimetidine, which is Tagamet. The main job of these drugs is to stop the acid from forming by binding to H2 receptors, so the histamine cannot bind there and cause acid production. That's about as deep as we're going to get into that. I don't want to bore you and have you all snoozing. How about those proton pump inhibitors? That would be omeprazole, which is known as Losec and Prilosec. Esomeprazole, Nexium. I never call it by its generic. Lansoprazole, which is Zotin and Prevacid. Pantoprazole, Protium and Protonix. And Rabeprazole, Sodium, Pariet. These things shut down the production of stomach acid by inhibiting the proton pump, which is known as the hydrogen potassium adenosine triphosphate enzyme system. Aren't you glad you asked? Now, if you stop the acid and the stomach environment becomes more neutral, you automatically stop digestion. Remember, acid is to help digest. Now, that might be okay once in a while, but every day, unless you actually have ulcerations that need to be healed, which takes about 1 to 2 months, why would you do that? Add to the fact that most of the middle-aged and elderly people that those preparations are given to do not really have a problem with acid. It's a problem with base or alkaline excess. How can that be, you wonder? Well, I'm glad you asked. It can be because a base or alkali burn is worse than an acid burn. So just because you have burning pains in your stomach does not mean you have an acid stomach. You could have a base stomach. Or could be it's just nerves. There's a very simple test they used to do in the old days in the country doc's office. You swallow a string, then it's pulled out and tested on pH paper to see if indeed you do have too much acid. The modern equivalent of that is to swallow a pill that has a transmitter in it that samples the fluids as it goes through your stomach. And then you get a nice printout of the changing pH values throughout. Now, how many people do you know who are on things to reduce stomach acid who have had either of those two tests done? Think about it. How many people do you know that are on those things? I've never had a patient who came to me with those tests. even if they have had several doctors who have all agreed that they needed to be on anti-acid drugs. Allow me to ruminate for a minute. Now, if you have no idea if someone has an acid or base problem, how can you prescribe something for acids? Especially when we know from research that people have more alkaline or base stomachs as they reach late adulthood. What is the likelihood that they need something that reduces stomach acid further? Just thinking about it. You know, it's one of those things that make you go, Okay, let's go on with the digestive process. Where were we? Oh, yeah, the stomach. From the stomach, the chyme, remember, that's what we call it once it gets swallowed, the chyme moves into the small intestine, which is comprised of the duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. In the duodenum, there is a thing called the enterogastric reflex that kicks in and closes the valve from the stomach when the duodenum is stretched and has certain concentrations of proteins and fats. The major part of digestion takes place in the duodenum. Now, the big thing that happens here is the chemical signaling of the need for several hormones to be released by the presence of fats in the duodenum. These hormones are called cholecystokinin and gastric inhibitory peptide, and these slow the emptying of the stomach, thereby allowing extra time to digest fats. This is important, and that's important because the small intestine is where the major absorption of nutrients occurs. Did you know that the surface area of the intestine is about the size of a tennis court? That's pretty big. This is necessary to properly and efficiently absorb the foods we ingest. What also happens is the action of the pancreas and gallbladder on foods. When the chyme enters the small intestine, chemical messengers cause secretion of several hormones, secretin, bicarbonate, bile salts, and disaccharide enzymes. Now, please understand that these are only a few of the total enzymes and hormones secreted. There are over 24 of these substances involved in digestion at this stage. If you really want to know what all those are and what they do, let me refer you to a book that I find fascinating by Dr. Russell Mars, M-A-R-Z, called Medical Nutrition from Mars. No, it has nothing to do with male and female. If you have ever had the pleasure of attending one of Dr. Mars's lectures, you know he is not only a certified wild man, but also incredibly knowledgeable in the field of nutrition and a heck of a lot of fun, too. And he really is a wild man. Let's talk a little bit about the pancreas and the gallbladder now. Do you really know what the function of either is? Quick quiz, pop quiz. What does the pancreas do? Okay, how about the gallbladder? All right, let's see if you're right. They are vitally important to your health. Unfortunately, many doctors tell you that your gallbladder is not important because it is only a sac that collects bile and has nothing to do with the production of bile. What they neglect to tell you is that the gallbladder sac is responsive to the chemical messengers that are secreted by the duodenum. Those messengers tell the gallbladder how much bile to release and when. The way the gallbladder works is this. It is a sac which accumulates bile, which is an emulsifier of fats. Think of bile kind of like dish soap, but not that caustic. The liver secretes the bile, but it is stored in the gallbladder. When the gallbladder is signaled by the duodenum, which is also known as the proximal end of the small intestine, that means the near end, when it's signaled that there is fat present, the gallbladder releases bile to emulsify or break into small particles for absorption. By the way, bile is made from cholesterol, which is synthesized from the fats we eat. Now, remember back in part 3, in the section on fats, I mentioned that fat is needed in the diet to absorb vitamins A, D, E, K, and CoQ10? So if you do not have the right fats in your diet, you cannot produce cholesterol, which means you cannot produce bile, which means your fat-soluble vitamins cannot be absorbed, nor can the fats themselves, which means you cannot produce cholesterol. Well, you get the picture. That's one treadmill you don't want to mess up, believe me. Now let's see if you've got the picture here. Fats go into the duodenum, and chemical messengers signal the gallbladder to pump bile on them, which causes them to break into absorbable particles. Got it? Next, the presence of carbohydrates and proteins in the duodenum causes chemical messengers, mostly that would be the hormone called secretin, to signal the pancreas to dump enzymes. And those enzymes would be trypsin, chymotrypsin, carboxypeptidase, ribonuclease, elastase, lipase, cholesterol esterase, more alpha amylase, phospholipase 2, and colipase. And they secrete that into the duodenum, as well as bicarbonate, which alkalizes the acid. Now, if the bicarbonate from the pancreas is not enough, and you are a type O blood type, and you have picked up either Helicobacter pylori or Campylobacter, you might just get a duodenal ulcer. Or, if you're under too much stress and have a problem with the pancreas, which causes the acid not to be alkalized, you could develop an ulcer there. Let me give you a picture of the anatomy of these important structures. The pancreas stretches from the duodenum to the spleen. That tells you a lot, huh? And it lies behind the stomach, so basically from your right side to your left, under your rib cage. And the gallbladder sits up underneath your liver, on your right side, just above the stomach. Got the picture? Okay, now see little tubular structures going from the gallbladder into the duodenum, which is a big tube coming off the stomach on the right side of your body, and from the pancreas going into the duodenum, sort of on the left side. Now that you have the mental picture of the structures, hopefully you're not saying, ew, allow me to explain a few really important points about these two things. Wait, let me take a deep breath here and try to present this in an uncomplicated manner. Okay, let's look at the gallbladder first. As I mentioned, it is a sac, but a sac that can release bile in the correct amount for the amount of fats in the duodenum. How can that be, you wonder? It's because the chemical messengers let the gallbladder know how much is needed. If you have had the gallbladder removed, you have lost that capability. Most conventional docs believe it's no big deal to remove the gallbladder because it's the liver that produces the bile, and they see the gallbladder as just a sac and unnecessary. They say your liver is still making the same amount of bile, so what's the big deal? Well, as you might have guessed, I will tell you what the big deal is, at least from a naturopathic standpoint. The big deal is this. Bile is produced constantly by the liver and trickles out constantly, meaning in small amounts. While some fat may be emulsified, the majority will not. Remember the treadmill I told you don't want to mess with? How are you going to absorb the proper fats in your diet or make cholesterol from fats that are not there? Or make bile from cholesterol that is inadequate, etc.? The problem that occurs after gallbladder surgery is that bile salts and digestive enzymes are seldom prescribed to the patient. Again, because the docs think it's unnecessary. Then about, 20 to 40 years down the line, depending on your overall condition, the patient goes into intestinal malabsorption and is on the downhill slide out of here. Of course, by then, the surgeon has long since forgotten about the patient. The current doc is likely to think the patient is having problems just because they are old. Yeah. I tell you this because I have seen too many physicians who have forgotten anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry, and how the body is supposed to work. And I'll tell you, I have had screaming arguments with some gastrointestinal docs over this issue, wherein I have used the M word in describing their behavior. And in case you're wondering, M stands for moron. I tend to get a mite aggravated when someone is so pig-headed, and here I must apologize to the swine species for comparing them to humans, so pig-headed that they refuse to think about the problem in a logical, rational manner. In most cases, the problem can be easily reversed, if diagnosed soon enough, by the simple addition of a supplement that contains bile salts and digestive enzymes. You can get such a supplement over-the-counter at most health food stores. And if you're about to run out and get such a supplement, let me caution you first. Be sure that the problem you are getting the supplement for is really the problem you need to deal with. Time for another detour here. If you've listened to me before, you know I take a few detours. Let me first say that I love health food stores and the people who staff them, who are trying so hard to help those who are suffering. Then I must say to those people that unless you have a medical degree or some kind of background that qualifies you as a physician, please stop diagnosing people over the counter. I ask this for a number of reasons. the most obvious being that you don't know what you're doing and might cause harm. The other reason that most people are unaware of is that the FDA has been trying to close down health food stores and any physician dealing in natural cures for quite some time now. They love to cite the danger to the public about health food stores and the danger that the clerks represent and, by association, that they think naturopathic physicians must represent. They even want to ban the books that teach you how to heal yourself. Perhaps you have heard of the Codex Alimentarius? That has been in place in Europe for a while now, and they have been trying and trying to get that in place in the USA for some time. The Codex requires that all nutritional supplements be classified as drugs. Let me read that again. The Codex requires that all nutritional supplements be classified as drugs and be produced by pharmaceutical companies. Do you understand what that means? It means that you would no longer be able to get what you want over the counter. You would first have to go to a physician. Now think, how much does an office visit cost to your physician, never mind the time off and the travel and all that? Then, you would have to convince said physician to give you a prescription for the supplement. And if you could go to a naturopathic physician, good luck trying to convince a conventional doc, who, by the way, knows pretty much squat about nutrition, unless that's their main area. Then, you would have to take that prescription to your favorite pharmacy, stand in line, and wait for it to be filled. The final thing you would get to do is pay an exorbitant amount for the RDA of the supplement, say 60 milligrams of vitamin C for $60, when you might really need 6,000 milligrams, which you can get now for about $18 for the really good stuff. Is anybody worried out there? I am. The Codex Alimentarius was formed strictly to protect the interests of big business people. Big Pharma, that is. They claim it is to protect the public, but that is an outright lie. If you'd like to know more, check out this site, www.4-rath-foundation.org. That's www.4-dr-rath-foundation.org for the history behind it all. We have defeated the Codex before, and we need to keep defeating it or we are in trouble. Okay, I'm climbing down off my soapbox now. Check out that site. You'll be amazed. Time for a story or two. Settle down, kids, and let Dr. Valerie give you a few anecdotes from practice. I should have like an echo in here or something. There are some physical symptoms one looks for to diagnose gallbladder problems. They are considered screening tests and point to the need for further tests, such as an ultrasound of the gallbladder. They don't always work. Yeah, they don't always work. This one I'm going to tell you about fits under there's always got to be the exception category. This also fits in the why you don't use the health food store clerk as your doctor category. I had a young woman come in, complaining of feeling terrible and giving me a history of some pretty strange things. She had been almost struck by lightning, like a hit within 4 feet of her, which left, well, kind of a jangled feeling. So she was checked out at the hospital and pronounced to be normal. A little while later, well, I think it was a few weeks, she ended up in the emergency room with anaphylactic shock. Remember we talked about that in part one of instructions for the suit, about allergic reactions? As I questioned her, I discovered that what sent her to the hospital was some supplement that she added to her regimen, which consisted of about 50 different substances. That's right, 50. She was a very frequent customer at a health food store which shall remain nameless. I did my exam and found nothing strange other than that she had dark circles under her eyes and looked, well, older than her stated age, and very tired. She was complaining of constant fatigue and digestive upsets, so I got her to agree that she would immediately stop all supplements and allow me to dictate what she should have after a few weeks of dietary changes and what we call a supplement holiday, which means you take some time off from taking any. Now, she did not improve, which had me shaking my head. After all, she was pretty young and seemed in fairly good shape. What the heck could the problem be? After a while, she admitted she had not stopped taking the supplements. We had a long discussion about that, with her promising me that she would stop. The next few visits, she got briefly better, then worsened suddenly. Again, we had a long talk, where she admitted she had added a few things recommended by the health food store clerk. She promised she would not do such things again, and I got her to promise she would call me before buying any more supplements to add. She did call a few times, and I told her not to buy those things she was considering and why. Meanwhile, I had referred her to a gastroenterologist, who also could not find anything overtly wrong with her, but scheduled her for an ultrasound of the gallbladder anyway. We both agreed, hey, when in doubt, check it out. It was weeks before she could get in, so we continued. She got worse. Yes, we had another long talk. She finally admitted that she had bought the things I advised against and had been taking them and had added several others. To say that I was frustrated would be to put it mildly. Trying to compose myself was difficult. I finally told her that some people are very in tune with their bodies and are able to understand what might be good for them, but she was not a good doctor for herself. She asked me if I was insulting her. I said yes. I wanted to be sure she heard me. I wondered why she bothered to come to me for help when she had no intention whatsoever of taking my advice. She refused to give up her self-medicating behavior, so I suggested she find another physician. It was glaringly apparent she was not about to allow me to help her. I also suggested psychological counseling. Well, the end of the story was she called me back the next month to tell me the gastroenterologist had found 3 gallstones the size of quarters and was going to take out her gallbladder. She was angry that I hadn't found them. I reminded her that I did indeed perform the physical exam that normally points to that problem, and it was me that sent her to the gastroenterologist in spite of the negative exam. I also pointed out that many of the supplements and medications she had been on could cause gallbladder sludging. Thank goodness I haven't had any more patients who have been that addicted to what health food store clerks recommend. Tripping all over myself, it just frustrates me to no end. Her problem was not only that she was addicted to the health food store, but also that the clerks were getting her excited about each new supplement they were pushing each week. She had them all and was taking them all. As I mentioned before, health food store clerks are not physicians, and they don't understand how the body works. There can be pretty major repercussions when you start dumping chemicals, organic or not, into the body without recognizing what systems you may be damaging. Now, there have been several cases of digestive upsets of long standing that magically disappeared when the patient started taking digestive acids and bile salts and enzymes. Now, the first thing I ask when I find out a patient has had the gallbladder removed is, are they taking such a supplement? I think I've only had 2 in the last 6 years that were taking digestive enzymes, and they didn't have the bile salt component in them. The other thing is the diet. If you have gallbladder problems or have had the gallbladder taken out, stop eating high-fat meals. Let me repeat, stop eating high-fat meals. I always figured that was a given, but apparently it's not. If you are one of those who lives in the fast food lane, you are getting way too much bad fat. Stop it! Okay, back off the soapbox again. Okay, here we go with the gross stuff now. Remember in part 2 when I mentioned what happens without bile? When I was talking about cleansing, colonics in particular? In case you didn't catch that one, I'll relate it again. Actually, it's a funny story. Well, I was working at a clinic that had a colonic set up. Remember, colonics are colon irrigation or fancy enema? I got to be the one assigned to that job. One day, a 30-something woman came in requesting help with her sinuses. She had such bad sinus problems that they were about to strip off her mucosal layers with a laser. She didn't really want that, yet, like, duh, and asked if there was anything we could do short of surgery. She was a fairly healthy, athletic, busy, professional woman, just the kind of person I like, trying to take care of herself and intelligent. Well, I did the exam, and I told her she needed a series of colonics. She looked like I was crazy, and told me that although she had bouts of constipation, she was usually okay, and asked what her sinuses had to do with colonics. I told her the colon has reflex points in it, just like hands and feet, and the colonics would affect her sinuses by clearing out the obvious blockages. Okay, so maybe the blockages in her colon weren't obvious to her, but They fairly screamed at me. Her spine was also out of alignment from about mid-back onto lower back. And remember, the nerves that handle your digestive tract started about mid-back. She was still doubtful. I told her if I didn't prove my point, there would be no charge. So we embarked upon the great colon cleansing adventure, as well as the spinal realignment process. The first colonic, all that came out were hundreds of undigested pills, mostly oil capsules, but also a good variety of compressed caplets. The look on her face when she saw a seemingly endless stream of undigested pills was priceless. Or rather, it was about a $40 value to me when she paid the bill. When she returned for the second colonic, a week later, she said she thought her sinuses were better, but wanted to make sure it wasn't just her imagination. The second colonic was almost as bad as the first one, hundreds of undigested pills. The third colonic only had a few, but lots of old mucoid substance came out. By the fourth one, she was convinced I told her the truth. Her sinuses cleared up, she avoided the surgery, and she felt much better. When she got on the bile salts and digestive enzymes, her digestive problems disappeared. Now, if this seems too simple and just a lucky coincidence, let me remind you that health is a simple thing. If you just let the body do its job, that is. The problem is, we eat things that cause the body to secrete large amounts of protective mucus from one end to the other, practically every meal. And in case you're wondering what one end to the other is, it's mouth to anus. Then, eventually, that mucus hardens and prevents proper absorption, leading to disease and aging. There's other stuff that happens besides mucus, but we'll get to that later. Do you know what happens if, for some reason, the bile duct is blocked, say by a stone or a growth or something stuck in the intestine? It's considered an emergency, as the bile will back up and fill up the liver, which then cannot do its job. And remember, you cannot live without the liver. That's why we call it the liver, which brings me to another point, that of a gallbladder flush. It seems that everyone has heard of some kind of gallbladder flush, the most common being olive oil and either green apples or lemons. Most conventional docs will snort if you mention it and tell you it's absolutely worthless and all you're doing is making expensive soap. They claim that no one has ever found any crystallized substance in a lump flushed out that way. I can't speak to that because I haven't researched it. However, I can tell you what I personally experienced when I tried the green apple and olive oil flush. On the third day, when the purge is supposed to happen, I dutifully drank my 4 ounces of extra virgin organic olive oil, and I recommend getting the best you can find, as trying to choke down that much oil is not pleasant, even though the oil is not unpleasant tasting. It's just very oily. About 2 minutes after I drank that, I felt my gallbladder contract. It squeezed so hard, so fast, that I grabbed my side and yelled. And it's not that it hurt, but rather that I had never felt anything like that. And that was one of those situations where you kind of go, oh, crap. I hope I haven't really screwed myself up. Well, what came out next time I had occasion to have a bowel movement was about 30 of the most beautiful emerald green oval lumps you have ever seen. Being grossly, pun intended, curious, I fished a bunch out and cut them open. What I found was that every one of them contained some kind of gradually substance which grated and crunched when I cut through them. Were those stones? I don't know. Seems awfully suspicious, though. Now I wish I'd sent them to the lab to be analyzed, but I wasn't thinking about that back then. Here's the precaution. Make sure that you know you don't have any stones too large to be flushed before undertaking one of these do-it-yourself cures. I'm here to tell you that the intense purge caused by that amount of oil will definitely move whatever is in the gallbladder out. If a stone is too big to get out and down the duct, you could suffer a rupture, and that is an emergency. Likewise, if the stone gets stuck and prevents passage of the bile. If you're really stuck on trying that flush, please inform your physician and get some tests, like the ultrasound of the gallbladder, CT scan, MRI, whatever they want to test you for, to ensure that you do not have any large stones there. Of course, your doctor may try to talk you out of it, but that's between you and your doctor. Has all this been galling enough? Sorry, I had to do that. Would you like to move on to some stories about the pancreas? Did you know that diabetes is a problem with the pancreas? Type 1, or juvenile diabetes, is the one you're born with or get during childhood. That type has to be on insulin replacement, always. Type 2, or adult-onset diabetes, is usually dietarily related and can usually be controlled by proper nutrients, diet, and exercise. It's common for the elderly to develop diabetes due to the pancreas shutting down more with age. Here's the simple down-and-dirty explanation of what happens in type 2 diabetes. You feed your suit way too much sugar, which has the effect of punching the pancreas, which causes it to produce more insulin to get the excess sugar out of the bloodstream and into the cells. After many years of faithful service, the pancreas starts to wear out. Usually, sometime before that happens, the cells start to become resistant to the insulin, and that's what we call syndrome X prediabetes or insulin resistance. If you correct your diet at this point, it can usually be reversed fairly easily. If not, you go into diabetes. At first, you are prescribed what are called oral glycemics, or drugs that lower blood sugar. Some of the most popular are Actose, which is pioglitazone, or Takeda, and Avandia, which is rosiglitazone, which are both insulin sensitizers. Then there's glipizide, glyburide, and glucotrol, which are sulfonylurea drugs, which causes the pancreas to release more insulin. That's the kick in the pancreas. Then there's glucophage and metformin, which are biguanide, which stops the liver from producing so much glucose, because the liver can produce glucose. It's called gluconeogenesis. And then there's Glycet, which is miglitol, and Precose, which is acarbose, which are glucosidase inhibitors, as well as a whole host of combinations of the above and also the old-time drugs such as diabinase, ornase, etc. This is by no means a complete... This is not about diabetes. So let's get back to the pancreas. If you're getting the inkling that sugar is not good for your pancreas, give yourself a gold star and please accept a polite clap from me. Basically, what happens after a lifetime of abusing your pancreas with sugar is you're given the above drugs to, in effect, beat a dead horse. By the way, cirrhosis of the liver is not the only thing that happens to alcoholics. They also commonly get pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of the pancreas, which is very serious, and they get pancreatic cancer. Now remember, alcohol is a sugar too. If you look at the way we have been encouraged to eat since childhood by the major food corporations, our diet here in the USA has been loaded with sugar. Although, if you've ever traveled through Mexico, you may have noticed that pretty much everything has sugar in it. Having spent a few months traveling through Mexico, I appreciate being able to eat food that is not loaded with sugar. And let me tell you, my pancreas appreciates it too. Time for another story. Just one this time from my intern days. An elderly man was brought in by his daughter, suffering from a bout of pancreatitis. His doctor ordered colonic irrigation, which I performed. He came in twice daily for a few days, each time getting better than the previous time. By the end of the week, his pancreatitis was gone. I gave him a diet to follow and discussed it with him, not only the diet itself, but the reasons behind it. I'm big on education. His daughter called me up a few days later and said he was feeling poorly again. She had gone to see him and found him at his breakfast table, happily shoving in a big stack of pancakes dripping with syrup, with a half-eaten box of donuts on the table and a big cup of coffee loaded with sugar. Shocked, she asked him about his diet. He told her I had told him he could eat all that he wanted of his favorite foods. Said favorite foods consisted of white flour products loaded with sugar, soda pop, coffee with sugar, beer, and cereal. Ugh! Now, obviously, I had told him no such thing. Instructing her to bring him back in for more colonics as well as more dietary counseling, I suggested she stay with him during the visit so we could clear all this up. She agreed, and we did our best together to get her father to retain the dietary information. She called me back the next week, stating he just wouldn't adhere to the diet and kept insisting that the doctor told him he could eat all his favorite foods. Sure as hell wasn't me that said that. At that point, I suggested she put him in a nursing home or group home with dietary restrictions or in the hospital before he killed himself with food. I wish I could say that people always did what I advised where their health is concerned, but I can't. Maybe part of the problem is not understanding how the body works. How can you make yourself change your habits and take better care of the suit if you don't really understand how important it is to do so? That is what inspired me to put this whole Instructions for the Suit series together. Now let's move on down the digestive tract, figuratively, to the jejunum, which is the next part of the small intestine. Most of the absorption of nutrients takes place in the jejunum, while the digestive juices come mostly from the pancreas and gallbladder. The ileum is the part of the small intestine that is just before the large intestine. The valve between is called the ileocecal valve. The main thing to know about the ileum is that that is where vitamin B12 is absorbed. Did I mention that B12 is necessary for the health of our blood? Without adequate absorption of this vitamin, one heads down the road of anemia, also inability to digest due to lack of hydrochloric acid, fatigue, depression, memory loss, psychosis, peripheral neuropathy, immune dysfunction, spinal degeneration, and a host of other problems. For those who are pregnant, the fetus would be impaired. You might have heard of neural tube malformations associated with that and wondered, what the heck does that mean? Well, the neural tube in a fetus is the entire nervous system and spine. So you can see it's pretty important. The absorptive surface in the small intestine is known as the brush border, which is the pear-like projections of cells whose responsibility is to transfer nutrients into the bloodstream. Through the small intestine, not only is liquid and nutrient absorption carried out, but also secretion. Roughly the same amount goes out as comes in, with a slight increase in the amount absorbed. And that goes through the kidneys. Remember that part? What I want you to understand here is that the small intestine is where most of the liquid and solid you take in as food and drink are absorbed. This is an extremely important part of the suit's digestive system. There are several things that can upset the absorptive ability of the small intestine, which is known as malabsorption syndrome. Think about it a minute. This approximately 20-foot-long tube is where cholesterol, vitamins, and minerals are absorbed, as well as water. How long do you think your suit will last without this part of it functioning? I can tell you it took me less than 6 months to go from a vital, physically fit, happy individual to an aged, decrepit, osteoporotic basket case. And I can tell you that intestinal malabsorption is extremely painful. I got to the point that whatever I ate came out chewed and recognizable 10 minutes later, along with whatever water I drank. Everything was the same color as when I ate it, and the water was clear. Believe me, you do not want to go through something like that. And it takes a long time to reverse that kind of a situation. So what can cause such a terrible malady? Well, antibiotics for starters, and quite a few other medications, antacids, too much magnesium, excessive sugar, parasites, celiac disease, allergies, pancreas problems, insufficient bile, chronic diarrhea, inflammatory bowel disease, stress, and nutrient deficiencies. Another thing that can happen in these cases is what we call leaky gut syndrome, which is where larger particles get absorbed directly into the bloodstream due to the intestinal structure breaking down. These larger particles are recognized as enemy by the immune system, which launches an attack, which makes you feel very fatigued and can cause a histamine surge. It has been postulated that that's how autoimmune disease starts. For instance, let's say you love chicken and you eat it a lot. You also eat lots of other stuff that causes problems with your gut. You get put on antibiotics, don't replenish with the proper flora, and maybe get some other medications too. After a while, the intestine starts letting in larger and larger particles. Soon, the immune system jumps in and attacks your chicken, which is very similar to the cartilage in your joints. Before you know it, boom, you have rheumatoid arthritis. Autoimmune diseases can be reversed, but it takes a lot of time and requires that your hyperactive immune system gets calmed down for at least a few years. This is not the time to supplement with immune boosters. That just makes it worse. It is the time to make sure you aren't around a bunch of sick people, as the last thing you need is to make your immune system go to work. Now, before we leave the small intestine, let's look at the ileocecal valve a moment. Did you know that problems with that valve can also cause problems in keeping spinal alignments. Those who have regular chiropractic care are probably familiar with this one. The problem is the valve can get stuck open or closed, and neither is good. The valve should open when the maximum absorption of chyme has gotten through, the nutrients have gotten through, and then usually you can help that with diet. Okay, on to the large intestines. This is where the rest of the water you swallowed gets absorbed, along with some nutrients. This is also the common site for bowel cancer, which you probably heard referred to as colon cancer. Yep, the large intestine is the colon. Contents travel somewhere around 5 centimeters per hour here. We call the speed of the chyme bowel transit time. Bowel transit time is usually between 12 to 18 hours. Shortened transit time means not enough nutrients or liquid gets absorbed. Longer transit time means more constipation. A transit time of 48 hours or longer can lead to increased risk of colon and prostate cancer. You may have heard about probiotics or maybe acidophilus, which are friendly flora or bacteria, that help us to better absorb our nutrients. We actually need about 8 strains of different bacteria, not just one. Some of them actually make vitamins for us, which is why we need them. And that's what you call a symbiotic relationship. You know, I'll wash your back, you wash mine. Some help the health of our intestinal cells, and they do that by breaking our food into short-chain fatty acids called butyrate or butyric acid. Butyrate feeds our enterocytes, or intestinal cells, thereby giving them the energy they need to do the job. And you can purchase this over the counter. The cow's buttermilk fatty acid is butyrate, and caprolate is goat's milk butter fatty acid. And those are fairly cheap from food store. That's one of the things I took to heal my intestinal malabsorption. Okay, now we get to the assimilation part. You see, it's one thing to eat and digest, then absorb, and quite another to assimilate. Assimilation is about what happens when the absorbed nutrients get into the bloodstream and go their merry way through the body. This part will be fairly short since I don't want to bore you with all the biochemistry concerned with this part, nor do I necessarily remember even 50% of it. I think I mentioned before that my favorite poster is one showing the complete biochemistry of the body, and it's huge. All right, let's follow the absorbed nutrients just a little here. Remember that the nutrients get into the bloodstream. After that, they get carried to the liver. The liver can be considered to be the factory of the body. It performs over 500 functions. Not only does it take apart nutrient molecules and recombine them into what the body needs, like with CoQ10, but it's also responsible for storing and creating glucose. Now, I love CoQ10, so indulge me a minute while I explain how the liver gets us what we need. All food has a Q something in it. Lettuce has about a Q2, chicken has about a Q9, shrimp or lobster has Q10, etc. What happens in the liver is both the disassembly of all the Qs and the reassembly into Q10s. Neat, huh? Our cells require CoQ10 to make ATP, otherwise known as adenosine triphosphate, as fuel for all their processes, and that's just one of the jobs the liver does. Now, when the liver gets done with the manufacturing process, it sends the packets out into the body, where they find their way into our cells. The next part of assimilation has to do with the cells themselves. There is a transport process that involves not only nutrients going into the cells, but waste coming out. If anything mucks up that process, the cell may die. Remember the chicken heart story? The cell membranes require fats. They're made up of what's called phospholipids. They require proper fats. Improper fats that might get into the cell membrane are known as trans fatty acids. You might remember that as margarine. And since the body doesn't know what to do with such a synthetic substance but needs lipids or fats for the membrane, it stuffs them into the membrane, which then becomes very stiff and doesn't function as well. Our cell membranes need to be fluid. When they are fluid, they are healthy and resist aging. Do I hear someone going, out there? I'm sure I just heard a few light bulbs go on, too. You guys' light bulbs are really loud. Once inside the cell, the nutrients are used to create the products our suit needs. You see, each cell is a little factory on its own, making DNA, RNA, enzymes, proteins, all sorts of goodies. Then we get into metabolism, but that would be a whole other book to get into. Time to review a little, in a very simplistic manner. Digestion starts in the mouth, with mechanical and enzymatic breakdown, and continues in the stomach and small intestine. Absorption starts in the small intestine and continues in the large intestine. Assimilation starts when the molecules are absorbed and sent into the bloodstream, go through the liver, and into the cells. Make sense? Hopefully you have seen that each step in the process is important. I like to think about the Creator putting this all together. And as I like to say, God don't make no junk. Everything in our suits has a purpose, as do each one of us. Heck, no one's a waste. They can always serve as a bad example. And everything has a reason, even the things we consider to bad. Now, I will go into more instructions for the suit at another time. We're going to go to more live shows after this segment. But for now, we have a little bit of time left, so if anyone is listening and has a question, please call it in, and I'll do my best to answer your questions. And until then, I'm just going to talk a little bit about what you can do from a natural kind of a look. If you want to improve your digestion, the simplest thing to do is take digestive acids. And there's lots of digestive acid combinations out there. Usually they're going to have something to digest protein, carbohydrates, fats, everything, and starches. So they will normally be combined, and you'll see so many units of this and so many of that. A really common one is bromelain, which comes from pineapple. And if you're going to eat a pineapple to get this, you need to eat it within 15 minutes of cutting it open, and the bromelain is in the core. So that's a very common thing that we use for people that are doing intense physical training. And, you know, if you're sore, you get that muscle soreness, that's lactic acidosis. So you take the bromelain, and that wipes that out. Now, bromelain will also make your blood really slippery, so you have to be careful you don't take too much of it. But if you're getting a digestive acid, it will normally have some of that in there. It'll have protease, lipase, carboxylase, amylase, and some of them will throw in some probiotics also. The probiotics that you want to get that are the absolute best are the ones that are called human microflora. And I'm not sure if those are available over the counter right now. Most of the probiotics that you would get were, you know, things like Acidophilus, the bacteria that we replenish with. Most of those are actually from bovine source or cows. So they will help, and they'll decrease diarrhea and things like that. The thing is that they don't stay in your intestines. They won't repopulate. They'll just stay there, and then every time you poop, they flush out, and you have to take some more. So what I commonly do with my patients is I will give them a thing called human microflora, and it has to be refrigerated, and, you know, it's way expensive. But they only take that for 2 weeks. And then they're done with taking it unless they're on a pretty long course of antibiotics. But that will actually repopulate the intestinal wall, and then you've got, you know, a good mix of the right bacteria. And there's several of the probiotics that have been shown to actually reduce aging and to help support the DNA by their functions. And if you think about what I talked about vitamin absorption and how some of those bacteria actually produce vitamins for us, it kind of makes a lot more sense. Now, the other thing that you might want to do if you're having any kind of a digestive problem, say it takes a long time to digest your food, besides taking the digestive enzymes, you could start out by taking something that kind of gets your system going. And, you know, a lot of people will want to take a tincture or something. There's lots of tincture formulas out there. But ginger is a really good thing because it's warming and it helps your stomach to kind of get prepared. It's a hot herb. And so you can take ginger tea or chew a couple pieces of the ginger candy, you know, any way that you want to do it. But basically, try just with some ginger. And then add some raw garlic to your meal, unless you really hate garlic. But garlic is so good for you. Normally, garlic will sharpen your appetite. And so if you've got an appetite problem, I usually tell people sprinkle some garlic powder over something, and that will sharpen your taste buds enough so that you enjoy eating the food. And there's different things for different people. If you're having a digestive upset and it's all related to the fact that you've been eating the wrong foods, well, then that's pretty easy. Stop eating the wrong foods. You know, I'm not going to tell you how to get past eating poorly, because it's not just the upset in the stomach that's the problem. It's also what happens later on as it goes down through your intestines. And Then there are other things. If you have too much acid, there's plenty of different antacids you can take, and there's different herbal tinctures you can take that help with that too. But you really need to be with a physician that understands this stuff if you want to combat that. Other than that, it's pretty easy to help your system by not drinking a lot of water with the meal. You should drink your water about 30 minutes before the meal. So if you're real thirsty, sit down and, you know, drink a quart of water, whatever you need. But wait before you have your food. And the reason I suggest this is because your digestive enzymes are made in a certain amount. If you're not drinking a lot of water, you're not going to be making enough digestive enzymes. Or if your system is too compromised from illness or something like that, it's going to be difficult to have enough power in your body to make the enzymes. So you don't want to dilute them. And you also don't want to be combining the wrong types of food together. You want things to work easier. You want things to be simple. So as I talked about in the nutrition portion of instructions for the suit, it's very important to make sure that you're helping the body as much as possible to do its work, especially if you're fighting illness. You know, if you just want to be healthier and stay young-looking and things like that, then I applaud you, because it has to start when you're younger. You can reverse aging a bit, you know, by checking out your digestion and assimilative processes, but it's really hard to go back to looking like you're 20 if you're already 60, you know. Anyway, hopefully this has helped you and cleared up a few issues with digestive stuff. If you have any questions, you can email me at info@drvalerienmd.com. And that's info@drvalerienmd, which stands for Naturopathic Medical Doctor.com. I'd be happy to answer your questions. And as I've mentioned on the other recordings, this does not substitute for proper medical care. You know, the disclaimer stuff, yada, yada. You know, see your doctor if you have any questions. And, you know, I'm not suggesting anything personally for anybody on these sessions that I'm doing. But, and I can't do that either over the Internet unless you want to do a consult fee and, you know, sign paperwork and all those kinds of things. So thank you for listening in. I appreciate it very much. And next week you will be listening to a pre-recording of an interview I did with Dr. Masaru Emoto and Messages from Water. He's fascinating and has some fascinating things to say, so please tune in for that. And then the two weeks after that, December 6th and 13th, I will be talking with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. She is in Louisiana, and she wants to get out the truth of what's happening there. So it's going to take 2 weeks to do that. And I'll give you the schedule for the other interviews and pre-records and things after that. So thank you again for tuning in. And Dr. Fred Bell is up next. And if you haven't heard him, please stay on and listen to him. He is an amazing guy and has some really important information for everybody. And not only is he absolutely brilliant, but he's really a cool guy. Thanks for listening. This has been Enlightened Medicine with Dr. Valerie Olmsted.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.